New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in many of the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is living in an apocalyptic age. This is going to be something of an open-ended conversation between myself and Charles Upton, who has been a guest on New Thinking Aloud many times. He is a poet. His first two books of poetry, Panic Grass in 1968 and Time Raid in 1969, were published by City Lights in San Francisco, known for publishing the works of the great Beat poets. And Charles, at that time, was considered the youngest member of the Beat generation of poets. He was still in high school then. He subsequently became engaged in metaphysics and the traditionalist movement, and is author of many books, including Hammering Hot Iron, a spiritual critique of Robert Bly's Iron John, Folk Metaphysics, Mystical Meanings in Traditional Folk Songs and Spirituals, Knowings in the Arts of Metaphysics, Cosmology, and the Spiritual Path, The Science of the Greater Jihad, The System of the Antichrist, Truth and Falsehood in Postmodernism and the New Age, and many others. Charles lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Charles. It's been quite a few months since you've been with me on New Thinking Aloud. I'm delighted to be with you again.
Yeah, I'm very glad to be back. I always enjoy these.
Yeah, they've always been very special to me as well. And today is a very open-ended conversation. I'm not sure where things will end up. It gives us a lot of freedom to go in different directions. But the general theme that you outlined for me, and I think it's appropriate, is living in an apocalyptic age. And I guess a good starting point would be to define what we mean by an apocalyptic age.
Well, you know, certainly, you know, the fears that we all face these days are pretty, pretty obvious. We don't have to belabor them. You know, I mean, we could have World War III, you know, nuclear war, and it's certainly, climate change and all of that, and the whole long list of social breakdown and crazy distortions to the human form, you know, transhumanism and everything you can think of. Any direction you look in, you know, you could spend a life of paranoid conspiracy theories any way you look, you know. So we all know that. So what is apocalypse, you know, traditionally speaking? Well, apocalypse is a Greek word that means revelation. And which is interesting, because if you look at all this, you know, danger, breakdown, threat of annihilation, that's one thing. But the effect of it, probably the central effect of it, is to reveal everything that's been going on in the collective human soul for eons. It's all here, you know, the aspirations and the beliefs and the crimes and the attachments of all the karma of the human race for this whole eon, for this whole world age or manvantara, is now coming to the surface. And that's very interesting. I mean, and one of the things that happens when that comes to the surface is that any attachments that an individual or a collective have not worked through, which, you know, in Islam, we call those idols. Idols aren't just statues of stone. You know, idols are things that we absolutize other than the absolute. You know, I have an absolute belief in X, Y, or Z, or an absolute attachment to I've got to have X, Y, or Z. And we treat them as if they were God. We treat them as if they were absolute reality. You know, there's no discussion when it comes to that belief, or there's no discussion when it comes to saying that's what I got to have. And so you go for it. So you see people coming up with all of their idols to come to the surface. Over Father's Day in the United States, 73 people were murdered and over 300 people were injured because people were having fun. It's time to have fun. You know, the weather's warm, if not hot. And so we go out, we go to the beach, we go to the streets, we go wherever we go to the rock concert and we have fun. But people can't have fun anymore in the old way because too much is boiling under the surface. That's why people can't drink like they used to. You know, I mean, you know, social drinkers. I mean, I'm thinking of my father was, you know, certainly he functioned quite well his whole life as a social drinker. But nowadays, he might have been looked at as an alcoholic. You know, he was just, you know, all of his friends were drinking the same amount, and that's what you did. If you do that now, you know, there are so many terrible feelings just under the surface that, you know, and especially if you and everybody else are very well armed, then you have an atrocity, you know, that there's no leeway. So that's, you know, we can talk about apocalypse in, you know, in environmental terms and geopolitical terms, but it's also a universal personal thing for everybody. And I shouldn't just look at the whole world and say, well, the whole world must be like the United States, because it's not. You know, I have a wife of one of my Sufis who, you know, grew up in Canada, and she was working as a nurse in Germany, you know, for some years, and she's just moved here to be with him in New York. And they asked her, well, how's the old USA look? And she said, she was shocked, you know. It's not, things don't work and things are weird, you know, as compared to Canada or Germany. So that fact can be used if we recognize that everything is going to come up anyway from the deepest layers of our own personal psyches and also from the collective layer of our personal psyche, you know. Because there is a collective unconscious and in which we share the human dilemma, and our particular sector of the universal human dilemma is going to come up and be in our face. So knowing that, instead of, you know, going for a number of different things, absolute distraction, right? Absolute, you know, I'm going to get the best video game I've ever seen, you know, with virtual reality goggles in the metaverse, and I'm going to go in there and never come out. You know, if you can afford it, that's what some people are going that way, you know, or drug use, or, you know, no Mr. Nice Guy, the gloves are off. It's time to be serious about, you know, my group and my cadre, and we'll go to war with the other guys, you know, which you see that internationally, but you also see that, right, you know, socially in the US of A. So, instead of doing those things, if you realize that these impulses and these beliefs are idols that need to be overthrown, you know, that's the big thing in Islam, is overthrowing of idols. You know, when Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, when he and the Muslims finally conquered Mecca after Mecca being, you know, trying to conquer them in Medina, you know, and sending raids against them and going after them. Finally, the tables turned, and he got to the Kaaba, you know, the temple in Mecca, which was then filled with all these pagan gods, It was filled with these pagan gods because Mecca was situated to be a pilgrimage and a trade route. You know, it didn't produce a lot itself, but it was just situated perfectly so the different caravan routes and stuff could cross at that point. And so, you know, it said, well, you know, we'll have a marketplace of gods, so all the different peoples who come in will be happy, you know. And so he said, no, there's only one God, and we're going to make that very clear. So he got rid of the idols in the Kaaba. Well, the Sufis say the Kaaba is your heart, you know, is the center of your consciousness, the center of your, you know, individual human being, where it connects with transpersonal, you know, divine being, you know, that the point of intersection. And that's what needs to be cleared of idols. So, you know, it's very easy to transpose that overthrowing of idols to the psychological and the spiritual level. So this is what our task is, because they're going to come up. And how do we release them? What do we do? You know, we have to have a sense that there is an absolute reality, however we define that reality, that shows that these various beliefs, attachments, impulses are severely relative. They're not, no one of them are it. Only it is it. You know, there's no God but God. Only there's no, you know, the absolute reality is what shows up contingent, incomplete, and finally ephemeral nature of all the idols. So if you can get to somewhere where you say, oh, that's what's going on, then the apocalypse is, or apocalyptic times, but I don't just mean, you know, when the button is pushed or when the asteroid hits or whatever, and that's it. I'm talking about apocalyptic times, where we have some time to think and feel about all these possibilities. That's what's interesting. You know, if we were all wake up dead tomorrow, okay, that's the end of that. But that wouldn't be as interesting as saying, my God, we're still alive. You know, look at all, and what next? And all of that, that brings up everything. So we learn to release these things and say, you know, as Muslims say, there is no God but God, you know, and the rest, you know, takes a back seat. And if these things are toxic to us, toxic to our relationships and such, we can say, well, goodbye to all that. And it's almost, these things are almost being pulled out of us. You know, in earlier times, how am I going to overcome this problem myself psychologically or morally or spiritually? You know, it's worked. I've worked and worked. I've fasted and prayed. Still got this problem. You know, and it's a lot slower. Now, potentially, it can happen very, very rapidly, you know, because the intensity of the apocalyptic energies of the world is energizing and all the different, everything, whatever is in our psyche, you know, is getting super energized, you know. And when New Age people talk about, you know, we're going through a paradigm shift and going to new level of consciousness, you know, well, that's kind of, you know, I wouldn't put it that way, but that's kind of what they're saying, whether they know it or not. All this stuff is coming up. So, you know, the question is, how does one cooperate with that process?
I gather that a large part of what you just said is that we get into trouble because of our belief systems, that ultimately any belief system is going to fall short of ultimate reality because ultimate reality is unknowable.
Well, that's one part of it, which is absolutely correct. You know, it's let's see, in the Muslim Salat, the daily prayer, you know, that there's based largely on different surahs of the Quran. One says, of Allah, he neither begets nor is begotten, and there's nothing to which he can be compared. You know, he's absolutely transcendent. You know, you can't say he's got secondary gods that he projects, and you can look at him in those terms. He's beyond all that. He is absolute and unknowable. On the other hand, there are parts which say, well, you know, he's like a lord of the day of judgment, and he's like a king, and he's like different, you know. So in Islam, you have two things. You have tanzi and tashbih. Tanzi is what you just said. Totally unknowable. God is absolutely transcendent. On the other hand, if he was totally unknowable, there would really be no universe, because the universe is, you might say, the ensemble of all the attempts of all sentient beings in the universe to know God. The universe is made up of all our different takes on the unknowable, you know, in on what level. That's what it is. And so we can't, you know, actually, that's always beliefs and takes on things and perceptions, although they're not absolute, that are still useful, are always going to be there. So you have to deal with the fact that that's what is called tashbih, is comparability. Tanzi means he can't be compared to anything. Comparability means he can be compared in some way to everything. The Quran says he does not disdain to coin a similitude. It's kind of a funny translation of even something so small as a gnat. You know, even a gnat is like God in some ways, not just, you know, the sun and the stars, you know. So, you know, you have to see both of those. Some beliefs are going to take you, they're oriented toward the absolute. At their end, they say, you know, their content is, there is no God but God, only the absolute is absolutely true, everything else is relative, and we can't fix on anything else. But that's articulated as a belief, and that's useful in the spiritual life. It's necessary in the spiritual life to have some set of beliefs that point you beyond belief. Some beliefs point you beyond belief. And at the best, that's what religion is supposed to do. It often doesn't, you know, because people make an idol out of everything. The worst idol of all is religion. You know, you know, I say religion is the best of pursuits and the worst of idols. But then the point has to come where you say, and yet, whatever doctrine that's been so useful, that has so much truth in it, that I have used or that I have fixed upon in order to live my life, you know, God is beyond that. You know, that's what, when Muslims say Allahu Akbar, that doesn't just mean God is the greatest of all. That means God is greater than anything you can conceive. If you say God is this, Allahu Akbar, he's beyond that, and on and on and on.
Well, I recall from one of our early conversations about the traditionalist movement and René Guénon and his thinking, that one of the articles that you described, I think, as an article of faith, is that we are, in fact, in apocalyptic times. And that would be quite striking, because in my understanding, particularly with regard to the Christian religion, ever since the time of Jesus, they thought this was the end of times.
Well, yeah, and when you go to the Hindus, which is where these terms Manvantara and the Kali Yuga, you know, which is the Dark Age, we're in, you know, I mean, I was watching something on YouTube, and the Hindus say, oh, we have 135,000 years yet to run in the Kali Yuga. You know, we've been in this for a long time, and we'll be in it for a long time. Well, I'm not sure that's useful. You know, I think those are symbolic numbers according to system, like the Mayan calendar goes back millions and millions and millions of years before there were ever Mayans, you know, and so, you know, that's just what happens when you start to play with numbers, you know, and symbolic numbers. But yeah, I mean, and the Prophet Muhammad said, you know, me and the hour, you know, the hour is the Muslim term for day of judgment. Me and the hour, we're like that, you know. And, you know, because it's the doctrine of Muslims that he was the last of the prophets, not the last, you know. I mean, revelation on a certain level continues, but he was the last complete prophet who gave a whole, you know, system of belief and system of ritual and system of morality and law, social, you know, social law, that's not going to happen anymore. So, yeah, it's true. And of course, people always say, well, the end of the world has been predicted, you know, for centuries and millennia. And everybody says, you know, when we got to the year 1000, people said, well, that's got to be it, you know, and then it wasn't it. And then we got to the year 2000 and people worried about Y2K. Remember that, where all the computers, you know, were set wrong and everything was going to go crazy, which didn't happen. But on the other hand, it's happening, as we can see. In every direction we look in, there is breakdown, you know, economically, environmentally, geopolitically, socially, psychologically. You know, it's happening. So now we can be a little more, you know, confident that we're not just going off the deep end by saying we're in apocalyptic times. You know, in other words, that set of ideas becomes more useful now than in many times before. On the other hand, the Black Plague was pretty heavy, you know.
One thing is for certain, which is that the human species now has the power to annihilate itself, which was not true 80 or 90 years ago. It's true today. And it's been true now since 1945.
Yeah, and it's taken quite a while for that to sink in to people. You know, and we see, when I was growing up, the fear was, you know, wake up tomorrow and we'll all be nuclear dust, boom, like that. And that didn't happen then. But now we wake up and say, well, maybe it'll never happen. But then we look at environmental destruction, we say, but that is happening. And that seems to be inevitable, of, you know, for a certain eon, you know, before us, even if everything doesn't, you know, blow up in a nuclear war. And now we're having the war in Ukraine, which is interesting because it shows you can actually have a hot war between sides who have nuclear weapons without it immediately going nuclear. We never thought of that before because we're coming out of World War II. Every weapon that had ever been created was immediately used, including nuclear weapons. And we froze. We said, better not go there. And now we decide, hey, maybe we can go there, you know, and we'll use the threat of nuclear war as a weapon as never before, you know. Which, you know, we just hear the threats coming from Russia. I'm sure they hear all the same threats coming from us.
This is probably an appropriate time to talk about your personal situation, because I think it's true that an apocalypse can be thought of on a social scale, but nobody is getting out of here with their body alive.
Yeah, well, you know, about a year ago, I turned up with a diagnosis of early stage colon cancer, and apparently it was the kind that doesn't grow very fast unless it does. You know, I mean, you never know. But so since then, I've been hitting it with a lot of herbs from and supplements. It's a huge long list, too long to give you, from an integrative medicine doctor here near here in Kentucky, and it seems to be. You know, there's no major signs, you know, as far as I can tell, that it's just taken off. But there you are. You know, you're in the world of, and you know, I'm saying I'm 75 years old. It's crazy I should have lived this long with my background. You know, as I was an alcoholic for 15 years, and I was a crazy drug taking hippie, and I've been in automobile accidents and the whole, you know, I just. You know, wow, still, so you do realize that very clearly you're living on borrowed time for a number of reasons. And so one of the things I probably did even before I got that diagnosis, but, you know, that was part of the same era of my life, is write my autobiography, because people said, I kept telling them my war stories. Oh yeah, me and Allen Ginsberg used to pal around all the time. You know, over there, you know, a bunch of, you know, the general bullshit of famous people I knew and famous scenes I made. And I was at the Democratic National Convention, and 1968 and rode freight trains across the United States, all this stuff, you know, adventure, you know, hippie-like adventure. And people say, oh, you got to write all this down. So I sat down and wrote a book, 465 pages. Boom. And that was interesting because you look at your life, it's like, you know, in near-death experiences, people have life reviews. And I had a slow, long, slow life review writing this autobiography, and I was trying to see the whole thing from a point beyond it, you know, which is in a certain sense the next world, but it's also just a sense of detachment, a sense of saying identities are ephemeral, you know, identities, you know, lead you through realms of experience. And then that experience is over, and then you better say, well, okay, that identity is over. Don't hold on, you know. Well, I mean, there are people who went through the 60s who hold on to that identity, and they're like the greatest generation, you know, who hit the beach at Normandy. And that's the last thing that happened in their life. That's what they remember. That's where all of their feelings and all of their vision of reality stopped, you know, and which is understandable, you know, that's the biggest thing that ever happened before or since. For some people, their D-Day was Woodstock, you know, they're stuck there forever. And so I just said, well, fine, look at those experiences, but don't hold on to the identities that, you know, that led you to that experience and that came out of that experience. That's another way of looking at the idols I was talking about. There are different identities, you know. This is that me. I want to be that me. I'll always be that me. No, you won't. Me's come and go.
I imagine when you get a diagnosis like that of cancer, and I'm fortunate that I haven't had, I think that's good fortune not to have had such a diagnosis. I'm never quite sure.
You can't ultimately know what is good fortune and bad fortune. You know that story, the Chinese story about the horse that, we don't have to say that again. You know.
No, we do, because all of our viewers won't know it.
There's a Chinese peasant farmer and his horse escapes and gets away, and his neighbor comes over to commiserate, says, oh, very bad, too bad, you know, your horse, it was a beautiful horse, it's gone, you know. And the farmer says, you know, well, you know, who knows? You know, he's gone, but who knows? And then the horse comes back bringing three or four other horses with him, you know, and now the farmer is enriched with all these horses. And so the neighbor says, oh, good luck, good fortune. You must be so happy. He says, oh, I don't know. Let's see. We don't know. And so his son is riding one of these horses one day and falls off and breaks his leg. And then the neighbor comes again and says, oh, terrible. It's too bad to hear about your son. You know, it's a broken leg. I hope he's okay. And, you know, bad luck. And the farmer again says, well, we don't know. You know, and so what happens is then the press gang, you know, that comes along who are, you know, forcibly drafting different people into the army, all the young men. But the farmer's son doesn't get drafted because he's got a broken leg. So he's okay, you know, and it goes on like that and on like that. And that's what you say about apparent good and bad fortune. So. But, you know, there is suffering, and suffering is, you know, that's real. You know, you say suffering, that is a misfortune. You know, on one level, that's undeniable. On the other hand, suffering, everybody has said suffering is a great opportunity, you know, but you need faith, and you need a belief, you know, a workable belief system like we were talking about that doesn't stick you somewhere, but is open-ended toward absolute truth. If you have something like that, you know, suffering, and my suffering has been basically stress and fear and uncertainty as to whether I can keep my life together on a number of levels, you know. which, you know, just that brings everything to the surface. For you have to absolutely turn, if you believe in God or whatever you believe in, whatever is your source of spiritual help, you're going to turn there completely. You're not going to say, oh, I got time, or, you know, maybe I can rely on something else. And you can't say that. So in a certain sense, that is the greatest good fortune. I don't have time. I never did have time. You know, maybe I can rely on something else. You never could, really. You know, every time you relied on something less than God, you had to pay for it every time. So now, you know, you see the true name of the game. Well, we call that good fortune, you know, God willing. That is the greatest good fortune, God willing. You know, you always have to say, you know, don't say it so easy.
Well, you bring up the question of suffering, and I think it's very clear that suffering is inevitable in this physical realm. Sooner or later, everybody is going to suffer, and many people are going to suffer a great deal. And so it raises the question, why does suffering exist in a world created by a benevolent deity?
Well, you know, and of course, the Buddha, who was the first person to discover that truth, nobody knew the first noble truth before the Buddha. You know, everybody thought everything was cool when the Buddha came and pooped the party and says, I'm sorry, everything is suffering. Even getting what you want is suffering because it's going to end. So he people asked him that question. He said, I'm not so interested in asking that. I'm just interested in how do we get beyond suffering? I want to use all my energy on that. Well, that was a creditable response. But from the standpoint of, you know, from theism, from a, you know, a benevolent creator, as we believe in my religion and in Christianity and in Judaism, except who knows what the Jews believe after the Holocaust. But that's a real question. Why the suffering? Now, well, there's nothing that roots out attachment to self and attachment to self-identity like suffering. The self that suffers becomes too hot to handle. You won't say, oh, there's good old me, you know, I'm so comfortable with that old self. No, you're not comfortable with me. You have to let go of that identity. In a condition of suffering, every identity that you hold on to and won't let go of becomes a source of greater suffering. So you're purified of this of fundamental attachments. And that's one way to look at it. Now it is interesting. I look at the near-death experience people, and you know the whole story is. And, you know, I'm of two minds of this. This could be, I'm sure this is what people experience in this world and the next on one level, is that before being born, I chose to go through X, Y, and Z. You know, and if I really wanted to get a lot of spiritual work done, I say, well, hey, this Auschwitz thing looks like a good deal. That'll get a lot of my karma worked out. Let's go there. Well, I don't know about that, you know, but that's the myth. I'm going to call it a myth, not because I think it's all wrong, because I think it is a very clear story that tells you something. And it's sort of, you're going to have to always look at that story. And the story is that we choose our lives before we come in. And, you know, and then people say, of course, and then you get back to the next world and you know, you know, there's great congratulations. You know, you get the Congressional or the Spiritual Medal of Honor, and you might have had a leg blown off, but you're a venerable veteran who everybody looks up to, and you're a hero, whatever that is. You know, there's something to that, but I wouldn't come down too hard on that. You know, it gives you a chance to say and to know that you love God, even with this, and your love deepens. And somehow you can see in the middle of that suffering a depth of love. You know, that because it's only finally the depth of love that can overcome the worst suffering. Nothing else has the power. The deepest love of God and love of all things in God will do it. But most people can't get to that without suffering. So that's one way to talk about it.
If a person is going to attain a certain degree of spiritual growth, let's say by going through Auschwitz, it strikes me that the role of the soul is to experience dissolution on every level. At some point, we may become stars and have to experience what a supernova is like, that this process just keeps going on and on and on.
Yeah. In the Quran, that is called all is perishing except his face. And that really means all. You know, all the forms that the soul assumes must die. And yet, in the presence of Allah, the soul is an eternal name of Allah. You know, and the Sufis, you know, seek that out in the spiritual path. The annihilation of all identities is called fana, you know, which is annihilation in God. And what comes after that, or what is sort of the other side of that at the same time, is called baqa, which is subsistence in God. You know, you are absolutely ephemeral, like the Buddha said, but you're absolutely eternal, like Jesus said. Those are both true. That's a mystery.
So what you're saying is annihilation in God and subsistence in God are somehow equivalent.
Well, that's what my first, you know, Sufi Sheikh, Sufi Master, Dr. Javad Nurbakhsh said. He says, you know, both sides of the same thing. And that's sort of a koan. How could they be both sides of the same thing? But somehow they are, because, you know, the end of everything less than the absolute is the subsistence of the absolute. And the absolute, as Ramana Maharshi said, is none other than you yourself on a certain level. You know, not you in your separateness, but you in your, you know, as the presence of the absolute self.
This is very interesting. It reminds me, Charles, of a conversation I've had with another guest, Bernardo Kastrup, who is, you may know, he's a dedicated idealist. He calls it analytical idealism. And when we talk about the afterlife, for example, his go-to response is, well, we just merge into the one consciousness. And that's it. He doesn't have much tolerance for thinking about such things as spiritualist communications or reincarnation. But it strikes me that what you're saying is a more complex reality where we can merge with the absolute, but then we may come out again and be reborn and find ourselves in a body once again.
Reincarnation is one of the reflections of that truth. You know, but I tend to take the view of reincarnation that the Dharmic religions take, is that you don't want to do this for the rest of eternity, do you? there is a way out of the wheel of birth and death, because there's something for me, and you know, other people may feel totally different. For me, there's something fundamentally sad in always becoming but never quite being able to be. You know, I'm this and now, you know, and you know, because as the Buddha said, impermanence is inseparable from suffering. So, but the permanence can't be the permanence of any conceivable you. It has to be the permanence of God. Yet the permanence of God is not other than you right now. You know, so, you know, you get to a place where language doesn't go beyond a certain threshold.
Well, I gather that except for the realm of poetry, language has a hard time dealing with paradoxes.
Well, yeah. I mean, if every tradition says, now, of course, the word is so paramount in Islam. You know, the Quran, this is the word of Allah, the word. And interestingly enough, Jesus himself was called the word, you know, which is interesting. You want to know what's beyond language, you know, in the Christian framework, look at Jesus. And he's beyond words, and yet he is the word, you know, the word that says it all right there, you know. And so, yeah, well, words always, it's amazing how close they can get and yet how far away they remain. And you can never fix upon them. Now, when it comes to the Quran, you could always go back and see, you know, something that has a truth that will apply to you and continually work for you. But if you understand it correctly, has, you know, an open doorway to what is beyond conception. I mean, when you say all is perishing except his face, you mean also all conceptions are perishing except the one reality they are attempting to be conceptions of. You know, so there is a practice, if I'm not mistaken, Sufism called, I think it's called Fakr, which is, and I may be wrong here, but that's translated as contemplation, which means something specific. It means poverty, which is like, you know, Sufis are called the fakirs or the fukara. You know, we're the poor ones. The poor in spirit who shall see God, as it says in the Gospels. And what happens is, in that practice, God generates, he sends you conceptions of himself. You want to, I reveal myself to you. I'm not hiding anything. I'm revealing everything I am. So here I am. You say, wow, now I see what God is. But then suddenly you say, but no, there's more to it than that. No, forget that. No, that's more. And then, oh, God is that. Oh, no, not even that. And there's a process of releasing your conceptions of God that are sent to you by God in the very presence of God, and keep saying, you know, there is no God but God. You know, God is ultimately exalted beyond all we attribute to him, and continuing, you know, to you entertain these conceptions of absolute reality, and then you go beyond them over and over again forever.
So it does seem as if the process of spiritual unfolding is almost an infinite process. I don't know if you ever get to the end.
You know, and that's another one of the big paradoxes, because you never get to the end from one point of view, but from the one point of view, other point of view, you have always been at the end, at the beginning, at the end, at the only place there is. You've always been there. And yet, when you look at it as a path to greater understanding and greater enlightenment, you know, in another sense, that is without end. I mean, Gregory Palamas in Eastern Orthodox Christianity came up with the idea of, you know, infinite progress in glory after you have led a good life and a saintly life and have died and have attained glory of the beatific vision, you know, that goes on and on and on and on. It doesn't you're not just always getting better and higher. It's just that eternity, while it never passes, is all dynamic, you know, and it's always new. There's nothing becomes stagnant. Nothing becomes matter of fact. And, oh, I've been there, you know, always more and more and more. Or, you know, but it never leaves the center around which everything orbits.
Well, I think I could say, for just speaking for myself, that I've had brief glimpses of that eternal state. Maybe they last only a fraction of a second, and maybe they happened 50 years ago, but I still remember the intensity of it. And it seems like, you know, in my little life, that's a lot. That's kept me going for nearly half a century.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that there, I said something years ago, which I said, you know, eternity won't last, you know, which, oops, you know, it's you know, and that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, it never stopped, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but this kind of knowledge is what's being offered to the whole human race now with our radically decreased ability to hold on to anything else, which means that sometimes we'll just hold on to the worst things. We'll say, well, reality is, if the world is this horrible, then horror must be the reality.
Yeah.
And you know, and this leads people to terrible atrocities or to Satanism or something, you know, just let's, you know, if there is a God, he must be evil because look at all this. So that's the devil, right? So let's go for that. I don't think that's the best way to go, as if that would settle it, as if you could say, well, the problem is I haven't sufficiently despaired. I have to go for absolute despair. Then I'll be okay because, you know, that'll be the end of all this trying to hope and things and all. You can never get to absolute despair, unfortunately. You can't quite make it, you know, but you can get, so that way is not a good way to go. You can get to absolute truth, absolute faith, and absolute love. That can be done.
Absolute truth, faith, and love. And I gather what you're saying is a love that is so sure that it can withstand even the annihilation of the body.
I mean, everybody goes through the annihilation of the body. And at one point, I mean, it's at one point, physical death after you really get there apparently is pretty easy. Mm. You know, so many people, oh, you know, I was so sick, I was in so much pain, and poop, popped out of my body. Now everything's okay. I mean, it is sort of physical death is the easy way. And so maybe physical death does not complete the process of self-annihilation.
Mm.
The thing is, you're still alive and your body's still here. And yet, you know, on all the other levels, you know, annihilation is staring you in the face. That's what when you go through the spiritual. You know, the spiritual annihilation. And that's more formidable. People are more afraid of that than they are of dying. You know, people say, oh, dying, that's, oh, all I have to do is die. That's no problem. You know, but you mean I have to stay alive and face this? Oh, crap. You know, that's what people really fear more. I always say if there is such a thing as reincarnation, which I have different, you know, different takes on, but
yeah.
My path does not use that concept. But if there's such a thing as reincarnation, it's because we're much less afraid of the suffering of birth and death than we are of the absolute death that would take us beyond that suffering. That's more terrifying to us. And so we'll just, you know, run from lifetime to lifetime so we don't have to come to the point of facing that.
I need to ask you to amplify a little bit what you mean by the absolute death.
Well, it's the death of all identity. You know, I mean, what you get from near death experiences is, I died, but I found out my identity was still there. Oh, what a relief! You know, yeah. I was bobbing around, but I was still me, and I was still recognized myself. I even haven't had a kind of a body and too much. You know, that's not the absolute death. The absolute death is indescribable, but you know, you find that the you thought existed never existed to begin with. There was nothing but God. And of course, that mysteriously, that's only one side of it, because God manifests as all forms. You know, he's not just, you know, the universe doesn't just get to a point where it's snuffed out forever and it never comes back and there's only God, but with no one looking at him, you know. Inevitably, he generates, you know, sentient beings who have different conceptions of him. That's the way it goes on. But there is the absolute That's like what Ramana Maharshi went through. You know, his story. I use him as the touchstone for Advaita Vedanta, which a lot of people do. And, you know, he was this normal kid who was sort of, you know, and he was athletic and he liked playing soccer or whatever you imagine kids back then doing. And then, there had been certain signs that his mother had seen when she was pregnant with him that, you know, were auspicious, but nothing special about this kid. And then suddenly he just comes and everything's okay in his life and no problems and no illnesses, no great poverty. And you know, kind of a middle class kid. And then he suddenly gets this terror of death. And it comes out of nowhere. He says, "Oh my God, I'm going to die." You know, and he looks around and says, "But there's nothing wrong. I'm not sick enough. You know, I'm my family's got enough money, and what's this?" But it kept coming stronger and stronger on him. And so the day came when he lay down and he said, "Well, if I'm going to die, why fight it? Let me just lie down and die." So he lay down and he imagined himself a corpse. And he said, "Okay, now I'm dead," you know. And he went on and on and on with that experience until he realized, everything I was is dead, yet there's something that doesn't die. You know, he went right to it. He didn't go to it through doctrine, through yogic practice, and through all the stuff that most people do. He was taken there immediately. And then there's a great story. You know, he somehow heard of Arunachala, the sacred mountain in South India, sacred to Shiva, and he says, "That's it. That's where I go." And so he was given somehow he stole his brother's college money or some of it so he could take a train to Arunachala, you know, which is, he's not supposed to, this is a saint, he's not supposed to do that. So he stole that money and he ended up at Arunachala, you know, in the Tier of Anamalai, where there were other yogis and such meditating on Shiva, you know. And he found a place to sit. There was a temple there, and he just sat. He said, "Okay, now I'm here." Blue. And he went to the deepest samadhi, Nirvikalpa samadhi, where everything disappeared. And he would be in there forever, and people would look at him and say, this person is going through something amazing, but when's the last time he ate anything? So from time to time, they'd wake him up, and they'd shove some food and water into his mouth, and then he'd say, and he'd go back. And so he went through this period where he was so impassive that apparently the insects were starting to eat his legs and things like this. He didn't notice. And then ultimately he came out and he said, well, he had so perfectly realized the absolute self that his phenomenal, you know, self or his phenomenal experience could come back and it wouldn't hide it. It was there. So who cares if you come back and now you have a body and a mind again? That doesn't change anything. That's not who you are. Who you are is that, you know? And that was so absolute with him. And then people recognized that this, you know, because he was streaming with light. Whenever, you know, this Shakti thing, whenever there is realization, there's Shakti. And he wasn't, you know, like one of these yogis that invokes the Kundalini and manipulates the Shakti and does various things with a divine power. He didn't do anything with it. It just did it itself because, you know, when you go beyond self-identification, there's a huge hole in things because almost everything in the universe is made out of some kind of self-identification. But then this hole appears, and into that hole rushes the universe. The whole universe has pure energy because something has to fill that hole. And that's what Shakti is. And so, you know, there were various manifestations of him, and he would know things he couldn't know, and he would produce objects out of nowhere, and he would bilocate them. But these are rare stories because he wasn't into that. He was not a wonder worker per se. That just had to happen because there's nothing to prevent it. So he became, you know, the sage Arunachala, and somebody came along and named him, well, you are Sri Ramana Maharshi. He says, okay, whatever. You know, I'm no longer named myself. So somebody else has to name me. And there he was. So, you know, that is like the absolute death, you know, but yet there he was. We talk about Fanala and Baka. He was all that he had been, body, speech, and mind was still there. He could still answer questions intelligently and run an ashram and circumambulate the holy mountain, you know, although he was a little bit feeble and they had to help him walk, but, you know, he could do it. And he was all there, but he wasn't there. Only God was there. Only the absolute truth was there.
What a wonderful story. And it suggests a kind of complexity to the way the universe works that's always going to sort of defy our attempts to turn it into a system.
Yeah, it is complex, but also it is host to an absolute simplicity. So if you can't figure out the complexities of it, which include reincarnation and Shakti and chakras and all whatever, all those different levels of being and all that, mm-hmm. If you can't ultimately figure that out or gain total power over it, so you can manipulate it for your own good or for the good of humanity, whatever, if that is beyond everybody's capacity, then there's nothing left but the absolute simplicity out of which it all comes.
Well, Charles, that is a beautiful note to end on today. I know we could keep talking a long time, but I also want to be mindful of your energy. But in particular, I want you to know that you're always welcome on New Thinking Aloud. Our viewers love you. You have a very strong following. Every time you're on the channel, people say, bring him back again.
The other thing I want to say to prove that I'm not perfectly annihilated is that I still do have a GoFundMe campaign for my illness. And, you know, it's just, I had so many other things that were problematic. You know, running out of money because my investments stopped paying because of the interest rates. And so, you know, and the house needs crazy repairs. And my wife and I need a huge amount of dental work. And then just, you know, and I said, well, you know, what can I do? And then I was lucky enough to get colon cancer. I said, now I can ask, you know. But I made it clear, you know, I got a lot of needs. I really do. So
we will publish a link to your GoFundMe page in the description attached to this video. So any of our viewers who would like to contribute to the wonderful work that you are doing and have been doing for a long time, I encourage them to look at the description and click on it and visit the GoFundMe page.
Yeah, if you want to keep me talking, you know, I mean, that's pay me and I will continue to eat. If I continue to eat, I will continue to talk. That's the deal.
It's a good deal. I encourage our viewers to take advantage of it. It's a great deal.
Hopefully it will be helpful.
We have a lot yet to talk about, so you have to stick around a while.
Yeah, I'll do my best. You know, God willing, inshallah.
Inshallah. Well, Charles Upton, once again, thank you from the bottom of my heart for staying alive and being with me today. And I truly hope that we have many, many more conversations because I find I gain every time we talk.
I can talk because you and people are listening. If nobody was listening, I would be tongue-tied. I wouldn't know what I knew. And I, this isn't even actually my knowledge. This is just the knowledge. You know, but if there's nobody to receive it, it never gets articulated. So all sides in this are necessary.
Well, that's why I close every interview by thanking our audience, because if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be here.
Right.
To be formal about it, for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because as I just said, you are the reason that we are here. Thank you. the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ celebrating his 90th birthday.